Welcome to episode 4 of Don't Talk to Strangers, a long look inside a series of child murders that took place in the Metro Detroit area in 1976 and 1977. Because we are discussing the murder and sexual assault of children, this content may not be appropriate for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. If you are just joining us now, please go back and listen to previous episodes first. In episode 3, we discussed the disappearance and murder of 13-year-old Jane Allen of Royal Oak. Because Allen had a history of running away, her case didn't get the attention it deserved in the media. Even after her body was found in the Great Miami River not far from Dayton, Ohio, her case seemed to be shrugged off like an afterthought. Jane's history of running away combined with the knowledge that she was hitchhiking? She didn't get a fair shake. Thankfully, Detective Jeff Muncy of the Miamisburg, Ohio Police Department is still working on her case. Before we dig into this week's story, we need to talk about some of the players. Up until now, I've been sharing the cases and the men suspected in each one. But today, we're looking at other players in this drama, and some of them may surprise you, especially since I'm starting with our setting, South Oakland County. The 4 confirmed victims of the Oakland County child killer lived in South Oakland County, in towns adjacent to one another, Ferndale, Royal Oak, Berkeley, and Birmingham. Each of these cities brushes up against Woodward Avenue. Woodward Avenue is one of the oldest roads in Michigan. It dates back to 1805, and she began just a few feet from the banks of the Detroit River, winding her way north through Detroit into what would become Highland Park, then leaving Wayne County for Ferndale, Royal Oak, Berkeley, Birmingham, Bloomfield, Pontiac, neatly slicing through Oakland County. And if you aren't from the area, Woodward is the answer to many a trivia question, as Woodward Avenue was the location of the first mile of concrete paved roadway in the United States. It makes sense that as people settled in Detroit and later expanded into the suburbs, that the area along Woodward became heavily populated. This is true of the 5 principal avenues originating in the heart of Detroit. Trace the path of Jefferson Avenue south to the downriver communities, or follow Michigan Avenue west toward Canton and Ann Arbor. Gratiot takes you to Macomb County, where the automakers have their plants and tech center, or journey northwest along Grand River toward the western suburbs in Lansing. We can't talk about today's case without admitting that the setting of our story, South Oakland County, is a big part of this drama. Now, I am about to drastically oversimplify complicated socioeconomic events that took place over a 60-year period, so bear with me. The city of Detroit built up quickly with the rise of the automobile in the early part of the 20th century. Henry Ford's car and assembly line changed the face of our country and changed the way we assembled goods. Mr. Ford offered jobs to able-bodied men ready to work the line. Aside from excluding women, these jobs didn't discriminate. If you were black or white, of Arab or Latino descent, there were jobs in Detroit for you. Between 1920 and 1960, thousands of people came to Detroit for work. There were jobs at the plants, sure, but the auto workers needed places to eat, sleep, shop, and drink. Plenty of work to go around, and many people arrived in Detroit with a work ethic and a dream, and Detroit delivered. However, in the years after World War II, the city struggled. During World War II, there were race riots. Detroit's white and African American communities clashed. First, it was on the assembly line, the Packard plant. The plant was busy building materials for the war, and they brought 3 African American workers onto the line, desegregating it, as was required by the U.S. government. This move was not well received by white workers who walked off the job. They didn't want to work beside an African-American man. Then, on Belle Isle, our beautiful River Island Park, black and white youths engaged in scuffles, mostly fueled by disagreements over who could use which beach or picnic area. Tensions continued to rise and the fights escalated. President Roosevelt was asked for help. He sent 6,000 federal troops to restore order. Of course, the riots of June 1943 aren't as well known as the riots of 1967, but they were bad nonetheless. More than 30 people died, most of them African Americans, at the hands of white soldiers or white police. After the riots and the end of the war, Detroit settled down, although there were still flares of racial tension. Detroit got back to doing what she did best, building things, creating, keeping America moving. And over the next decade, automotive technology improved. So did our desire to use our cars. We needed roads to drive on. And the Davison Freeway in Detroit was built during World War II. It's known as the nation's first depressed urban freeway. It was a novel concept in transportation. Wide lanes, higher speeds, get there faster, see what your car can do. And because so many of the Detroit auto workers had good paying jobs, they used their money to buy cars, and they wanted to drive those cars. So between 1945 and 1980, additional freeways are created in and around the city. Interstate 75 went north and south. Interstate 94, which linked Detroit with auto factories and airports in the western suburbs, that soon followed, along with Interstate 96. Suddenly, all those car-owning families, and yes, despite offering outstanding public transportation via bus, rail, and streetcar, most Detroit families owned cars. And there was room to move, room to drive. And Detroiters, mostly white Detroiters, chose to move. With new roads being built, roads and freeways, auto workers realized they could keep their good-paying job in Detroit or in Highland Park, but live in the suburbs and make a commute. So they moved to the suburbs, and by they, I am primarily referring to middle-class white families. There were existing towns like Berkeley, Pleasant Ridge, Wayne, and Farmington, but new communities were formed. Hazel Park, the town where my grandmother was raised, became a city in 1941. The city of Troy followed in 1955, Southfield in 1958, Farmington Hills in 1973. Neighborhoods were built and sprawl began to set in. Of course, I can't speak for everyone, but many of the families who moved away from Detroit were looking for a safer place to live. And when they said safer, they often meant whiter. The suburbs had few, if any, minority residents. The suburbs, and for the purpose of today's story, the suburbs means South Oakland County. Well, South Oakland County is supposed to be safe. The suburbs were thought of as virtually crime-free communities where families could raise their children far from the perils of Detroit. The exodus to the suburbs was a slow process over 30 years, and the riots of 1967 were the last straw for many white families in Detroit. The riots in 1967 were longer and more violent than the uprising in the 40s. This time, more than 40 people died, again, most of them African Americans killed by white soldiers or white police officers. When the riots started, the Detroit police asked for assistance from the Wayne County Sheriff's Office and the Michigan State Police to contain the situation, but again, federal troops had to be brought in. If there was an us-against-them mentality among white and African-American Detroiters, the riots only cemented that feeling. And white families continued to flee the city for the suburbs, headed to Warren, Royal Oak, Centerline, Westland. Again, listeners, I need to reiterate, I am simplifying a very complex series of events just to give you an idea of what the region was going through and the expectations of Oakland County residents. The families who left Detroit for the suburbs thought they were moving to a safer place to raise their family, which is what made these killings so terrifying. Things like this aren't supposed to happen here. Murders happen in Detroit, where the murder rate is in the hundreds. The suburbs are supposed to be safe. People thought an Oakland County address would protect them from crime, but in 1976 and 1977, they learned how wrong they were. Especially when 12-year-old Jill Robinson, who lived in Detroit her whole life before her mother relocated the girls to a Royal Oak neighborhood in the fall of 76, when Jill Robinson fell victim to a kidnapping and violent death, people didn't know what to think. Moving to Oakland County was supposed to be the better choice. If you couldn't get away from crime in the suburbs, was anyone safe? Were our children safe? And in 1976 and 1977, the answer to that question was a resounding no. In the late 1970s and early 1980s, I was the only child of two working parents. During the summer, there was no school to keep me out of trouble, so my mom sent me to camp. The YMCA on 11 Mile Road offered a day camp in June and July. Mom or Dad would drop me off each morning and I'd spend the day there. There was swimming and crafts and activities and the occasional field trip. In the afternoons, the counselors would let us run loose on the playground adjacent to the Y, right there on 11 Mile Road. The playground actually belonged to Longfellow Elementary School, an imposing brown brick building that was a busy hub of school kids from September through May and deserted when I saw it each summer. Most of the kids attending this summer camp, they lived in the area. They were from Royal Oak or Berkeley or Huntington Woods, and some of them even attended Longfellow Elementary. I suppose that's how I first learned about the dead girl. See, the kids weren't supposed to talk about it, and if the counselors heard you, it meant big trouble. You might have to sit out of swimming, or even worse, they'd have a word with your parents. That didn't stop them from whispering that Longfellow was the school where the murdered girl went, at least until she was murdered. Didn't you know? Hadn't you heard? She was kidnapped and then shot. The dead girl. Little me, a dark-haired kid who loved to swim, became very afraid of that school building. Because all I knew about it was that the dead girl went there, and it frightened me. And the girl the other campers whispered about? She had a name, but I wouldn't learn it until much later. Her name was Jill Robinson. In 1976, Jill Robinson was the oldest of three girls. She and her sisters divided their time between their mother and father's homes as the Robinsons divorced in 1974. In September of 1976, Jill's mother relocated from the city of Detroit to a house on Mayfield in Royal Oak. The house was near Catalpa, which is basically 11.5 Mile Road, and it was east of Woodward Avenue. Jill Robinson lived just 2.5 miles north of the home Mark Stebbins shared with his mother and brother. Jill's neighborhood in Royal Oak is nicer than Mark's, but she's just as close to Woodward Avenue. Mayfield is leafy and green and quiet, and the houses sit on spacious city lots. The architecture of the homes is varied and interesting. I can almost see Jill riding her bike up Vinsetta Boulevard, laughing as she pedals over the miniature bridges that allow traffic to cross the road. However, Jill did not settle easily into the house in Royal Oak. The move caused great anxiety, and she began having nightmares, dreams where she would wake up crying and frightened. Her sister, Aline, would fetch their mother to comfort Jill and help her get back to sleep. You see, Jill developed a nightmare-inducing fear, a terror so consuming that her parents could scarcely soothe her. Jill was dreaming of her death, and not just any death. Death by gunshot. The crack of the bullet, the punch of metal through flesh. It was horrifying and overwhelming and ripped her from sleep with a shriek and tears. While the shooting wasn't real, it was just a dream. Jill's body responded to the terror in a very real way. A hitch in her chest and then sobbing, gasping for air, crying out for a parent. Jill's recurrent nightmare of being shot gnawed at her. She talked to her parents about it, long conversations held on the edge of the bed while Mom or Dad held her and smoothed her hair. Jill wept and lost sleep, and the pattern repeated until her family enlisted the help of a therapist, hoping to combat the bad dreams that plagued the 11-year-old. I should mention that the nightmares and terrors didn't start until after her mother moved the girls from Detroit to the little house on Mayfield in September. While she'd moved from Detroit, a city with an ever-increasing crime rate, to Royal Oak, a peaceful suburb in South Oakland County, Jill no longer felt safe. Her parents and siblings tried to calm and soothe her, to help her feel safe and settled, but her parents, sisters, and loved ones had no way of knowing that Jill would be murdered, shot to death, before 1976 was over. Jill was a sixth grader at Longfellow Elementary, and she was active in Girl Scouts. When she wasn't in school, Jill liked to read. She was a quiet kid, and her life seemed normal, usual. There was nothing strange or unsettling going on. And while the nightmares still happened, pulling a terrified Jill tearfully from sleep, they were less frequent, less intense. I imagine that her parents thought the dreams were an adjustment. New home, new school, 12 years old. She's probably going through puberty. This too shall pass, or so they thought. On December 2nd, 1976, Jill Robinson celebrated her 12th birthday. Carol Robinson helped Jill plan a sleepover party, inviting 8 friends to celebrate Jill's special day. Friends from school and scouts attended the festivities. Jill Robinson has 3 weeks left to live. On Wednesday, December 22nd, there is a change in the Robinson family schedule. The girls, Jill and her younger sisters, are usually picked up on Wednesday afternoon to spend the night with their father, an English professor at Oakland Community College. Tom Robinson has a home in Birmingham, just a couple miles north of Royal Oak. Tom Robinson needed to change the visitation schedule that week and plans to see the girls Thursday instead. His former wife, Carol, had the girls Wednesday night. 36-year-old Carol and 40-year-old Tom had been divorced for 2 years. The visitation arrangement was nothing new, and going back and forth between the homes of their parents was just the way things were for the 3 Robinson girls. Changes in the schedule weren't a regular thing, but they happened, especially around busier times, and the holidays are busy and hectic for many families. In the late afternoon of Wednesday, December 22nd, Jill and her mother have a disagreement. Carol expected her daughter to lend a hand preparing the evening meal, and Jill was put out by the request. The two argued. Carol told Jill to, quote, get out, which was her way of telling her to find somewhere else to be, perhaps her bedroom or the front porch, but Jill needed to collect herself and get her feelings in order. Jill was not in the mood to do anything that her mother requested. Jill was angry, and instead of taking a few minutes to cool off, she grabbed the backpack from her bedroom. She stuffed a blanket and a couple of books inside and set off on her bicycle. As a mother, there are times you argue with your children, when you have disagreements. And as a parent, there are times when it would be best if your child was out of your space, because words are flying and some of them are harsher than you intended. And I imagine that Carol Robinson replayed this argument with Jill over and over in her head, wishing for a different outcome, wishing that she could take it back, that she could say something different, say something that would keep Jill in the house that night. While the beginning of December 1976 was unseasonably cold with single-digit temperatures that had the whole region shivering, by the week of the Christmas holiday, temperatures were warmer, back in the normal range for that time of year. December 22nd was a typical December day in Michigan. Temperatures are hovering near 30 degrees, and it's getting dark outside by 5 o'clock, about the time Jill took off on her purple bike. The sixth grader may have been heading north on Woodward Avenue toward her father's home. A family friend will later tell police that they spotted Jill riding her bike on Woodward Avenue, near 14 Mile Road, by the Tiny Tim Hobby Shop about 7 p.m. Keep that sighting in mind, because we're going to come back to it later. After their disagreement, Carol thought that Jill was sulking in her room, or maybe sitting out on the front porch, but Jill had left. Hours passed, and Jill didn't return to her mother's home in Royal Oak, nor did she arrive on her father's doorstep in Birmingham. Jill Robinson was gone. Calls are placed to the police. Their daughter, their quiet book-reading girl, was gone. Initially, police were not concerned. They said, oh, she ran away. She quarreled with her mom, but she'll be back. She's probably staying with friends. Now, if you follow missing persons cases, particularly those of missing teens in the 1970s, you've heard this refrain before. The kid got mad and took off, but they'll be back. Maybe they ran away. We heard the same thing back in episode 2 when Mark Stebbins disappeared. Remember? Ferndale hadn't had a kidnapping in 10 years? And let's not forget Jane Allen, who was murdered while hitchhiking to her house, but was dismissed as a runaway. It's frustrating to hear this, especially because we know how this is going to play out. But nothing was done that night. No teams scrambled, no searches, no Amber Alert. The Amber Alert system, which notifies the public via television, text, social media, or radio that there's a missing child, that's not going to exist for another 20 years. Aside from Jill's parents and family friends, during that first 24 hours, no one is looking for her. The Robinsons are upset with the police. Tom Robinson was particularly frustrated. Why wasn't law enforcement taking this seriously? His daughter, his child is missing. Today, when someone goes missing, police immediately take a report, and the missing person's information is entered into the Law Enforcement Information Network. In the 1970s, law enforcement didn't view a missing person, particularly a teen or almost teen like Jill, as a serious situation. Add in the fact that Carol and Jill argued before she went missing, and, well, we're sure she'll calm down and turn up. Christmas Eve marked Carol Robinson's birthday, and she didn't feel like celebrating, but she put on a brave face for her younger daughters, who were 9 and 6. Christmas morning dawned, and while her younger girls happily opened their presents, Carol didn't receive the gift she really wanted for Jill, her quiet, dark-haired daughter, to return home. I would imagine that Christmas morning, watching her younger girls open presents and seeing Jill's gifts, unclaimed and unopened, that Carol Robinson realized that her daughter, her quiet oldest girl, would not be coming home. Carol, who was named because of her own birthday being Christmas Eve, would never see Christmas the same way again. It's not a joyful holiday or a time for celebration. It is a nightmarish reminder of what used to be. In the early morning hours of December 26th, a motorist traveling north on Interstate 75 in the city of Troy spots something on the side of the road. Using the Citizens Band, also known as a CB radio, he called it in. A tri-officer responded and discovered the bloody remains of 12-year-old Jill Robinson. She was on her back in the snow a few feet from the shoulder of the road. Jill had been shot in the face with a shotgun at close range. I'm not going to get into details. Just know that it's as bad, if not far worse, than you can imagine. As a side note, I've spoken with the family of the officer that found Jill Robinson that morning. It's something that you never get over. The image of her small body in the snow, the knowledge of what was done to her, it never leaves you. The patrolman who came upon Jill's remains radioed in for assistance. The Michigan State Police are notified for a crime lab to respond to the scene. One can imagine that trying to collect and preserve evidence on the side of Interstate 75 during rush hour when it's snowing, it's a challenge. The shotgun blast obliterated Jill's features, therefore a positive identification could not be made. Responding officers noted that the clothing matched what Jill was known to be wearing when she left home on Wednesday, December 22nd. Bloodstains at the scene on the side of the freeway made it clear that she was shot near the road, not killed at a separate location and dumped there. Once again, we have a jurisdictional issue with the case. Jill was last seen alive in Royal Oak, both at her mother's house and on her bicycle headed north on Woodward. The missing persons report was filed with Royal Oak Police. However, Jill's body was discovered on I-75 just yards away from the Troy Police Station and is under the jurisdiction of the Troy Police. It does appear that the two departments worked well together in their efforts to find who killed Jill Robinson. Lieutenant Earl Ringer of Royal Oak Police coordinated with Sergeant George Reed of Troy Police to assist in the investigation. If you listened to the Already Gone podcast, you've heard Reed's name before. He investigated the Gravelin family murders back in 1964. And I'm certain that after responding to that scene more than a decade earlier, Reed hoped he was done dealing with murdered children. But he handled the Jill Robinson case like a pro. A Michigan State Police helicopter is used to search the area looking for clues, disturbances, anything that might lead them to where Jill Robinson spent her last days. They fly over Royal Oak and Berkeley, up Woodward Avenue and east along Big Beaver Road toward Interstate 75, hoping something will point them in the direction of Jill's killer. A list of items sent to the Michigan State Police Crime Lab showed that when her body was found, Jill was wearing black boots, an orange jacket, a blue jumpsuit, white underpants, navy socks, and red mittens, the same clothing she'd worn when she left home after arguing with her mother on December 22nd. When the body of 12-year-old Jill Robinson arrives at the Oakland County Medical Examiner's office, Dr. Robert J. Sillery performs the autopsy. Her cause of death is listed as gunshot. Jill's body showed no sign of sexual trauma or assault, and her remains were neat and clean. It is clear to investigators that she hadn't spent the last several days out in the cold. While her last meal was not made public, she'd been fed and cared for since disappearing on the 22nd, which left law enforcement wondering, who had kept Jill and where had she been those 3 days? Before we move on, we must talk about Dr. Sillery. I first learned of Dr. Sillery in 2016 while researching the still-unsolved murder of 18-year-old Deborah Rentschler of Detroit. Rentschler's naked, bruised body was found 20-some miles from her Detroit home 2 days before Christmas. Dr. Sillery did not believe that she'd been murdered and marked her cause of death as natural, saying that she died because of drug abuse and her death was not a homicide. How a drug-addicted teenager without a car made it from Detroit to Farmington without her clothing wasn't part of Sillery's equation. Thankfully, Farmington police worked her case like a murder investigation despite his findings. Deborah Rentschler lived a difficult life. Her mother died when she was very young. She was shuffled between the homes of various relatives and ended up in juvenile detention as a young teenager. Rentschler eventually turned to sex work to get by, living with her boyfriend/pimp. The 18-year-old had a final humiliation after her murder. She didn't receive a proper autopsy. Once the Oakland County Medical Examiner released her and she was buried, it was decided that a full autopsy needed to be done, and her body was exhumed months after her death. A full autopsy was performed at the University of Michigan Hospital, and that pathologist determined that her cause of death was strangulation. Sillery called the other pathologist's findings from the second autopsy, quote, a difference of opinion, and he focused heavily on the fact that Rentschler had both Valium and morphine in her system when she died. In mid-January 1977, just a couple of weeks after his examination of Jill Robinson, Dr. Sillery is arrested and charged with Medicaid fraud for actions at his pathology clinic. Sillery had an ownership stake in a series of laboratories that served the Metro Detroit area, and, according to the charges, there were issues of fraudulent billing. The charges filed against him in this instance would eventually be dropped, but I am certain that criminal charges hanging over him impacted his ability to do his work as a medical examiner effectively. And as galling as his treatment of Deborah Rentschler was, it wasn't her case that brought him down. It was the mishandling of multiple autopsies that ended his tenure with the county. Oakland County listed 919 cases where Dr. Sillery falsified autopsy reports and records. 919 cases. Sillery was officially hired by the county in 1977, and Oakland County moved to terminate him in 1981. Meaning he spent 4 years working for Oakland County, or approximately 1,500 days. Over those 1,500 days, there were 919 cases of falsified records. One could theorize that on two-thirds of the days he worked, Dr. Sillery was falsifying information on autopsy reports. It was Oakland County Executive Daniel Murphy who fired Dr. Sillery. Sillery countered that he couldn't be fired without a hearing. As a naval veteran, he is entitled to a hearing under the Veterans Preference Act. Sillery also went to the press, telling them about the, quote, Judas or dastardly persons, trying to discredit him. But when pressed for more information about those working against him, Sillery was unable to offer any names or evidence to back up his claims. After Oakland County agreed to pay Sillery benefits and vacation time, a package worth nearly $20,000, which is closer to $60,000 in today's money, Sillery resigned from the medical examiner's office in 1982. But his troubles were not over. In 1986, Sillery will be indicted in a, quote, large-scale pharmaceutical drug conspiracy by the U.S. Attorney's Office. Listeners, I find Dr. Sillery's involvement with this case concerning. If he falsified records on almost 1,000 cases during his tenure, I find it hard to believe that he'd suddenly change his methods and do a thoughtful, thorough job on the autopsy of Jill Robinson, and later when he performs an autopsy on Christine Mihalik. In case you were wondering, it was Dr. Patinga who performed the autopsy of Mark Stebbins back in February. Back to our case. The murder of Jill Robinson is different from the other four known victims of the Oakland County child killer, as she was the only victim to be shot. And if you're imagining a tidy bullet hole, you would be mistaken. The top of Jill's face and skull was obliterated by a shotgun blast. The first confirmed victim of the Oakland County child killer, Mark Stebbins, was smothered, likely by someone holding their hand over his mouth while pinching his nose closed, cutting off his airway. I need to mention here that this deviation from the killer or killer's usual method of murder does not eliminate Jill's case from being one of the four attributed to the Oakland County child killer. However, Jane Allen's still unresolved murder and the February 1977 murder of Valerie Bishop of Detroit These cases are dismissed as unrelated because they don't fit the pattern of the Oakland County child killer. I have come across a couple of theories as to why Jill's cause of death differed from the other three confirmed victims. One is that when Jill was found on the side of the road, she was wearing her backpack, and she was laying on top of the backpack. So when her body is laid down on the side of the road, the backpack forces air out of her lungs, making it sound like she gasped, like she's still breathing, that the killer failed to smother her, and that Jill Robinson was still alive. In a panic, the killer shot her. The shotgun does tie into the first murder. If you look back at Mark Stebbins' death, his head showed injuries, round injuries that could be consistent with the barrel of a shotgun. Another theory is that Jill fought with her captors and managed to bite one of them. She received a shotgun blast to the face to eliminate any possibility of a bite mark being matched by a dental impressions should the killer be captured. Finally, some believe that Jill told her captors of her fear, of the persistent, nagging terror that brought her so much anguish in the months before she died. She was so afraid that someone would shoot her. Did Jill confide in her captor that she was consumed by this thought? While she was being held, did she wake up screaming and have to explain the contents of her nightmare to the person who would go on to murder her? Did they shoot her to transform her fear into a premonition, making it appear that Jill predicted her own demise? Now, it's possible that, like Mark Stebbins, Jill Robinson also died of smothering, but was shot on the side of Interstate 75 for a reason known only to her killer. Within days of her body being recovered, Jill's bike, a purple high-speed brand bicycle with chrome fenders and a white banana seat, is recovered in an alley off Washington Avenue in Royal Oak. The bike is nowhere near the 14-mile in Woodward location where a family friend claimed to have seen Jill riding her bike the evening of December 22nd. Her bike is found in an alley just a few blocks from her mother's home on Mayfield, the opposite direction if she were headed to see her father. Now, I can't imagine Jill would just abandon her bicycle. In the 1970s, bikes were expensive and not likely to be quickly replaced if they were lost or stolen. Without her bike, Jill would have been left out of activities with her friends in the neighborhood. Whoever picked her up may have offered to transport her bike as well. Now, thinking back, I remember those big trunks on the cars in the 1970s. It would be easy to slip a child's bicycle into the trunk of your car if you're offering them a ride home or a ride to their father's house. There was much speculation among investigators about the bike being abandoned by Jill because she took a ride from someone, or that maybe the bike was dumped in the alley after she was taken to distract from the true location of her disappearance. Sergeant George Reed of the Troy Police Department, he told the press that he believed other people were riding her bicycle before it was found, meaning it could have been found anywhere and abandoned in that alley, and the location of the bike, not too far from her home, didn't mean anything. When investigators spoke with children who lived near the location where the bike was found, the kids admitted that many of them had taken turns riding the bike. This dashed any hopes investigators had of obtaining the killer's prints from the bicycle. A man approaching a young girl on a bike, even in December, isn't out of the question. If law enforcement had interviewed Jill's younger sister, Aline, in 1976, she would have told them about the man who had approached her weeks earlier, asking if she knew how to get to Longfellow School, the school that Jill attended. The man suggested that Aline hop off her bike and into his car. I don't think Aline was interviewed by law enforcement in 1976. Whatever course of action law enforcement was taking with this investigation, it appears that they didn't think her killer had ties to her neighborhood or her family. If they'd spoken with her younger sister, they would have learned that someone had approached her in the neighborhood weeks before her sister was taken. Aline's story about being approached by a man would not come out until 2014 when Aline is interviewed by a newspaper in her hometown in northern Michigan. She told them she'd been approached by a man asking for help getting to Longfellow School. Could the killer or killers have targeted the Robinson girls? Were they cruising through her neighborhood, just off Woodward Avenue, looking for a target? Starting the morning of Sunday, December 26th, police in Troy and Royal Oak put in a 70-hour work week focused entirely on Jill's disappearance and murder. Friday marks the New Year's Eve holiday, and in Troy, Sergeant Reed tells his investigative team to take the weekend off and come back fresh and ready to work on Monday. New year, new start. Meanwhile, in Redford, The family of Judy Farrow, murdered New Year's Day, 1976, is quietly marking the anniversary of her death. Before the month draws to a close, a small private funeral service is held for Jill's friends and family at the First Presbyterian Church of Royal Oak. About 50 people attend her service, making it very different from the large and public funeral held in Ferndale for Mark Stebbins. Immediately following the service, Jill's remains are cremated. Other than both cases, Mark and Jill's, being unsolved murders of children, law enforcement has not yet made a connection between the December murder of Jill and the February murder of Mark Stebbins. The press has, and the Daily Tribune newspaper runs a story titled, quote, "Four South Oakland County Killings Reflect Violence of Our Time," citing the deaths of Sheila Schrock, Mark Stebbins, Jane Allen, and Jill Robinson. No mention is made of Judy Farrow or of Cynthia Cadju, who was taken from Macomb County and dumped in Oakland County near the Franklin Cider Mill. Getting back to Jill's case, let's look at the evidence. Clearly, we have a change in the cause of death, from smothering to gunshot, although we have to keep in mind that Jill could have been smothered and then shot by a panicked killer when he left her on the side of the freeway. Jill's remains were left a couple of hundred yards from the Troy Police Station. Shooting her in the dead of night was risky. What if the shotgun blast had been overheard? Her body could have been discovered much sooner. Investigators know that the weapon was a shotgun and what kind of shot was used. 12-gauge Federal brand shot cup. These are a common variety, easy to obtain at a number of local stores, meaning the gun isn't good evidence. It won't help them narrow things down. Now, a witness comes forward, reporting that on December 26th, around 3:30 a.m., he was headed north on I-75 when he spotted a vehicle on the shoulder of the road near where Jill's body was found. He recognized the car as a Pontiac Le Mans because he'd owned one. He told police that the vehicle he saw had damage to the driver's side of the car and that the left taillight, the driver's side taillight, was broken. The witness thought it was a 1971 or 1972 Le Mans, and he may have offered up a color of the vehicle as much as he could tell on a dark night in a poorly lit freeway, but that information wasn't made public. The witness told the police that the vehicle was slowing down on the side of the freeway, but when his car caught up to it, the Le Mans sped up and returned to the road. Once he'd passed the vehicle, it again returned to the shoulder and stayed there. That's distinctive, don't you think? An early 70s Pontiac Le Mans with driver's side damage and a broken taillight. I'd be interested to know why there wasn't a search done for this vehicle. Remember this car, because we will talk about it again in upcoming episodes. We will also talk about another car, a blue Gremlin, but I believe that the Pontiac Le Mans with driver's side damage is the vehicle that should be focused on. The Michigan State Crime Lab looks at fibers and hairs on Jill's clothing, but there isn't anything probative found. She does not appear to have been sexually assaulted, and her body is clean. Not washed and disinfected, but she's clearly been cleaned up prior to being dumped on the side of the freeway. Her body and her clothing make it clear that she was not outside for the 3 days she was missing. There is no thought of DNA testing, let alone trying to obtain touch DNA from her clothing or knapsack. We are nearly a decade away from DNA being used to solve crimes, and decades away from considering that touch DNA could exist. If you're thinking that they should pull the evidence out once again and retest it, I have heard that the children's clothing was looked at a few years ago, but nothing of value was found. Keep in mind that in the 70s, first responders are not wearing gloves. This increases the likelihood of contamination. Now, as you're listening to this, the Oakland County child killer case is open and an active investigation, although you'd be hard-pressed to figure out who has jurisdiction over the murders. So far, the two murders attached to the Oakland County child killer are centered in South Oakland County. But as we move into 1977, things will change. And listeners, I have had no luck convincing any investigators on this case, past or present, to go on the record with me. But each and every one of them that I've spoken with has told me, with a heavy sigh, that they ran down everything they could. The men and women I talked to sounded drained, resigned, exhausted by the weight of this case and their frustration with it remaining unsolved. One of the reasons it has remained unsolved is a lack of evidence. They had ballistics evidence in Jill's case, the sighting of a late model Le Mans, but that's about it. No one saw her being picked up, and no one really saw her being dropped off or shot. There isn't a suspect description that they can hand out and pursue. Now, talking about Jill's case, I want to get a little bit ahead of ourselves and touch on a case we will discuss in a future episode, because there are connections here that lead back to Jill Robinson. While researching information on her case, I spent some time in a Facebook group for the city of Troy, a Remember When type group for people who grew up in Troy. And when the discussion in the group turned to crime, several people mentioned Jill's murder. Someone posted that Jill's family sometimes attended services at St. Alan's Parish in Troy. Now, when Timmy King is murdered in March of 1977, a parish priest from St. Alan's participates in his funeral mass at Holy Name Church in Birmingham. You see, the King family had previously attended services at St. Alan's. This is something I confirmed with Tim's family. It appears that the family of Jill Robinson and the family of Timothy King both attended church services at St. Alan's Parish in Troy. If you're familiar with the city of Troy, St. Alan's Church was off Coolidge Highway, just south of Big Beaver Road, directly across from Somerset Apartments. The church is no longer known as St. Alan's, but there continues to be a Catholic parish on that location. And this isn't the only link between Jill Robinson and the last known victim of the Oakland County child killer. Timmy King, the last confirmed victim, lived with his family in Birmingham on Yorkshire Road. The family that lived across the street from the Kings, their younger boy and Tim were very good friends. The boys were about the same age, they attended the same school, and they frequently played together. A daughter from this family was a babysitter for Tom Robinson's girls. She knew Jill Robinson and her younger sisters. So Timmy King's good friend and neighbor has a sister, a teenage sister, who knew Jill Robinson, who babysat Jill Robinson. Timmy King's family knew the Robinsons' babysitter, and the King and Robinson families attended services at the same Catholic parish. Maybe it's just a coincidence, but it's a strange set of coincidences in an already strange case. We will come back to and expand on these items when we talk about the kidnapping and murder of Tim King in a future episode. As 1976 draws to a close, there are five unresolved child murders in Oakland County: Cynthia Cadju, Sheila Schrock, Mark Stebbins, Jane Allen, and Jill Robinson. There are 9 police agencies in 2 states working these cases. Remember, Jane Allen's body was found in Miamisburg, Ohio. As 1977 begins, there are tips and leads coming in on the disappearance and murder of Jill Robinson. But none of this information leads to an arrest or to any sense of closure for the families. Unlike the large span of time between the murder of Mark Stebbins and the murders of Jane Allen and Jill Robinson, the community won't have time to catch its breath before the killer or killers select their next victim. Mark Stebbins was picked up on February 15th, a Sunday, the day after Valentine's Day. Jill Robinson disappears Wednesday, December 22nd. And her body is recovered on Sunday, the day after Christmas. The next child to be taken, Christine Mihalik, disappears on January 2nd, 1977, the day after New Year's. 3 kidnappings and murders linked to holidays. Today, you can retrace Jill's path from her home on Mayfield up Woodward Avenue toward the Tiny Tim Hobby Shop. The hobby shop is long closed. And Jill's school, Longfellow Elementary School, the building that frightened me as a child, is gone, leveled and replaced with new homes. The YMCA is still there, right on 11 Mile Road. And the swooping curve of I-75 at Big Beaver, that's still there. And each day, thousands of people drive past the spot where Jill's body was found. And I would guess that most of them aren't aware of what happened there on a cold December morning, 40-some years ago. Don't Talk to Strangers will return in January 2019 with new episodes. I'm Nina Instead, the writer, producer, and voice behind Don't Talk to Strangers. Our content editor is Joni Hubrid, research assistance provided by Grace Kaleza. You can follow the show on Facebook and on Instagram at Don't Talk to Strangers or DTTS Podcast. Thank you for listening, and please be safe.